This is the smell of a warm 3-day-old egg salad sandwich in a wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a hefty, ultra-strong trash bag with new Fabuloso lemon scent.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Smell the difference? When life gives you stinky, get Hefty Ultra Strong with new Fabuloso lemon scent. It smells like clean, freshly picked lemons. So no matter what's inside your trash, you can stop the stink and smell the lemon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Listener, Obscura is supported by people like you. So head over to patreon.com/obscurecrimepodcast to get access to bonus episodes, bonus content, and even merch. You get access to a massive backlog of bonus episodes, hours and hours of obscure content not released to the main feed. That's patreon.com/obscurecrimepodcast. Thank you.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
From the pages of the Pensacola News Journal, Wednesday, October 20th, 1982. Title: Decomposed Body Identified. Okaloosa County Sheriff's deputies tentatively identified the decomposed body found Monday evening in a trailer as that of 26-year-old Renee Johnson, an employee of a downtown night spot. An autopsy Tuesday night showed the woman died of several stab wounds to the heart, possibly as long ago as Saturday, said the First Judicial Court medical examiner, Dr. Edmund Kyleman. Listener, remember that name. Dr. Edmund Kyleman. We'll be hearing from him a lot. Sheriff Sergeant George French said Tuesday night that deputies had tentatively identified the murder victim as Johnson, but that dental tests would be taken to verify the tentative identification. Investigators had yet to unravel the events which led to the stabbings at the woman's home, Mott 135 Victory Mobile Home Park, on US 98. Deputies had no idea of the motive behind the crime. No information released to disclose the type of knife used. From the pages of the Pensacola News Journal, Friday, March 29th, 1985. Title: Lawmen Investigate Woman's Death. The FBI is looking for a possible witness in its investigation of the killing of a 19-year-old Valparaiso woman, whose body was found on the Eglin Air Force Reservation beach Wednesday. FBI Special Agent Mike Dill said investigators want to talk with everyone who was on the beach west of the Eglin Officers Beach Club from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. Tuesday. The body of Tommy Lou Whitten was found about a half a mile from the club. She went to the beach Tuesday and was reported missing late Tuesday night by her parents when she did not return. The FBI had no suspects in the case late Thursday. We have nobody that we would classify as a suspect, said Dill. But he said the agency is investigating the assault of another woman on the same area of beach a few weeks ago to determine if the two incidents are related. Dill would not say specifically if a composite drawing of a possible suspect had been made. We do not have one ready to release, he said. An autopsy performed Thursday morning shows that Whitten died of asphyxiation and blood loss, caused by a cut on her throat, said Dr. Edmund Kyleman. Dill asked that anyone who was on that part of the beach during the 5-hour period on Tuesday, or anyone who might have any information about the killing, to contact the Okaloosa County Sheriff's Department. That area of the beach where Whitten's body was found is not that isolated. In all probability, the incident occurred right where she was found. Dill has also declined to comment on whether the weapon used to cut Whitten's throat had been located or what type of weapon might have been used. Kyleman said the assailant used a sharp object to slash Whitten's throat. Whitten was severely lacerated on the front of her neck. The cut went through her air passage. Obviously, there was a good deal of bleeding. The opening in her throat allowed blood to enter her airway, and she suffocated. I feel that her death was, to one, asphyxiation, and to two, a fairly moderate loss of blood, said Kyleman. He said he did not know the object that was used to make this gash, but it was something with a sharp edge, like a knife or a broken bottle. It's believed that Whitten had not been sexually assaulted. Her body, dressed in a swimsuit, was found about 5 p.m. on Okaloosa Island Beach by a man walking his dogs. Whitten's car was found by a relative earlier Wednesday on Okaloosa Island, not far from where the body was discovered. The vehicle was examined by agents with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Crime Laboratory. From the pages of the Pensacola News Journal, Wednesday, April 10, 1985, title, Lawman Seeks Suspect Depicted in Drawing. Law officers Tuesday were seeking a white man in his mid-20s, who was also seen on an Okaloosa Island beach the day a 19-year-old Valparaiso woman was slain there. Three composite drawings released by the FBI depicted three similar views of a man between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., March 26th. The body of Tommy Lou Whitten was found March 27th, about a half a mile west of the Eagland Officers Beach Club. Her throat had been slit. An autopsy shows she died between noon and 5 p.m., March 26th, of asphyxiation and blood loss. FBI Special Agent Mike Dill said Tuesday night that he'd like to talk with him, find out if he was involved somehow with Whitten or just passing by. Dill stopped short of calling him wanted for questioning in connection with Whitten's murder. We've talked to a lot of people, Dill said. We hope the pictures will result in an additional people coming forward with information. They were released now because it has gotten to the point where there is some degree of accuracy to the description. The man was described as between 5'9" and 6 feet tall and weighed 165 to 190 pounds. With a trim build and brown hair, he had a possible blemish on his face. Dill said the man sought was similar in description to the one believed to be involved in the March 18th incident in which a man attempted to accost a woman on that same stretch of beach. From the pages of the Pensacola News Journal, Thursday, September 18th, 1986, title, No Suspect in Slaying, Woman Stabbed 21 Times. Okaloosa County Sheriff's Department investigators were tracking down clues Wednesday, but admitted they had no firm leads in the stabbing murder of a woman whose body was found Tuesday. Cynthia Sue Condra, 24, was last seen alive around midnight Monday when she left the home on Racetrack Road. She shared with her serviceman husband and another woman. Where she was going has yet to be determined, said investigator Don Vinson. Vinson said Wednesday he interviewed several people and planned to conduct more. Nothing's firm right now, he said, and we're not ruling anything out. Don Vinson himself had become obsessed with the case, speaking to over 100 people. Condra's body was discovered at about 3:45 p.m. in a brushy area off Duval Street, near the Okaloosa County landfill in Wright. The woman had been stabbed 21 times, said medical examiner Dr. Edmund Kalman. Most of the wounds were concentrated around the heart. Investigator Vinson said that the woman's van was found near her body, and Florida Department of Law Enforcement technicians dusted the van for fingerprints. Vinson adds he had heard technicians have lifted a few prints, but he hadn't seen them late Wednesday afternoon. Kalman said he thought the body had been dragged into the brush, but Sheriff's Department crime scene technician Jules Barrio said judging by the amount of blood on the ground and the position of the body, the stabbing didn't take place far from where the body was found. That's just a theory though, Barrio cautioned. From what I saw at the scene, Kalman said most of the wounds were in the left side of the chest, but a few were found in the woman's back and a few in her neck. Whoever did it was deliberately going for the heart, said Kalman. Death came when the sac surrounding the heart filled with blood from several puncture wounds to the heart cavity, restricting the heart's room and pumping it with blood. No weapon has been found, investigators said, but Kalman judged it to be a single-edged blade, about 1 inch, and it had to be a pretty stout knife because it went right through the breastbone and several ribs. Deputies were around Duval Street, which runs off the Beale Street extension, searching the area where the van was found. A Fort Walton man on his way home from work spotted a red belt hanging in a tree at the side of the road, and the body was a short distance away. Condor's body was fully clothed when discovered, said Kalman. There appeared to be no sign of injuries or assault. Normally, anyone who commits a sexual assault isn't going to dress the victim. Condor was originally from Tennessee and had children. From the pages of the Pensacola News Journal, Friday, September 19th, 1986, title, Investigators Lift Fingerprints from Murder Victim's Van. Macalusa County Sheriff Department investigator Don Vinson said technicians from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement had lifted the fingerprints from Cynthia Sucontra's van, which was found near where the woman's body was discovered. Now all we have to do is match them up with somebody, Vinson said. As many as 8 investigators from the state attorney's office and the city county's mutual assistance team were working on the case. Vinson said the investigation was concentrating on the van and the site where Condra's body was discovered by a man on his way home from work. Condra had been stabbed 21 times in the chest, neck, and back. Sex magazines and used women's clothing were found stashed in the woods near Condra's body. Condra's van was found abandoned and running. Keys were in the ignition. The van radio was playing. Blood was found on the passenger side door handle. Inside, a door latch, on the steering wheel, and on the back of the driver's seat. From the pages of the Pensacola News Journal, Friday, May 22nd, 1987, title, Investigator, No Clues to Murder, Woman's Murder Remains a Mystery. Sheriff's investigator Thursday would not say whether they have identified a suspect in the stabbing death of Audrey Gigi, age 47, of 345 Duval Street. Believe me, I wish I could tell you more, said Joe Nelson, an investigator with the Okaloosa County Sheriff's Department. Nelson said sheriff's officials have been interviewing and re-interviewing people who may have some knowledge of Gigi or her death. Gigi's body was found by a co-worker on the floor in the halfway of her mobile home. On the floor in the hallway of her mobile home, at 9:45 a.m. Wednesday, Gigi was employed by a Caltech, Florida, and when she failed to report for her shift at 7 a.m., the co-worker became concerned and went to her home, just south of Racetrack Road. The dead woman was recently divorced. Nelson would only say no comment when asked if the sheriff's department had any suspects in the murder. Dr. Edmund Kalman, medical examiner for Okaloosa County, was to complete an autopsy on Gigi's body Thursday. Listener, rummaging through these old discarded newspapers, it paints a picture for me. The image is of a community left in a state of terror, in which a man outstretched his arm, and the people of Okaloosa recoiled. And this man, this monster, was acting fast. But what he didn't know is that investigators were on his tail, closer than he realized. Dr. Edmund Kalman and Chief Investigator Don Vinson were working in tandem. And they were working hard. They had prints. They had DNA, artist sketches, eyewitness reports. Investigator Don Vinson just needed to get there when the body was still hot. No decomposing corpse or someone discarded on the beach. Don and his team were crouched and ready to strike. The stage was set. We just need our lead to stumble. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions you wish to ask. And then, she can either type her response or record her voice. and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventure, and the challenges she overcame. The book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Personally, I love My Life in a Book. I tried it with my mom, and I've heard stories I'd never heard before because, you know, they just never came up naturally in conversation. It's easy to use, and my favorite part is it's given me more of an excuse to talk to my mom more. You know, it's not always easy to come up with those on your own. Listener, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code Obscura at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code Obscura for 10% off today. Frank Athan Walls was born on October 12, 1967. According to medical experts, Frank Walls suffered from brain damage during his difficult birth in Germany, where his father was in the U.S. Air Force. In early childhood, he was diagnosed as hyperactive and prescribed Ritalin for his condition. At the age of 12, he contracted viral meningoencephalitis, inflammation of the brain that can result in psychiatric and developmental problems. At age 13, Frank Walls was placed in the emotionally handicapped program at school. A neuropsychological assessment when he was 16 concluded that he suffered from organic brain dysfunction, had a tendency towards psychosis and hallucinations, erratic mood swings he doesn't recall, paranoid tendencies, and poor impulse control. In 1985, a child psychiatrist assessed Frank as suffering from organic brain dysfunction, a bipolar disorder, a serious mental illness. In 2002, a psychiatrist's review of his case concluded that due to a combination of brain dysfunction and manic tendencies, Frank Walls was very vulnerable to committing violence as he became increasingly unable to handle adult responsibilities and demands. To put it bluntly, Frank Walls was both brain damaged and clinically angry. He was a ball of rage that couldn't be controlled, and they tried. Frank Walls operated with the mental capacity of a 12-year-old child. All through his adult life, he operated at this level, barely able to control his rage, barely able to get himself in check. He struggled to listen to authority figures, had oppositional defiance disorder to top everything off. And in 1982, when they found the body of Renee Johnson, Frank was only 14 years old, but he was quite big, especially for his age. She'd been stabbed 5 times, the fatal blow puncturing her heart. Tommy Lou Whitten was also in 1982. He snuck up on her when he was 14. She was sunbathing and he couldn't help himself. So Frank pulled out his knife and gashed open her throat. In 1985, when Cynthia Condra was found dead, Frank would have been 17. The woman was a mother of 3, and he left her discarded to bleed out on a clay road. And in 1986, when Audrey Gigi's body was found, he would have been 18. She lived alone and worked as an electronics assembler. This is all to say, and make clear, listener, that Frank Walls was a busy, busy man, and from a very young age. Now, let's get to the main event. During the early morning hours of July 22, 1987, in Okaloosa County, a neighbor heard loud noises coming from the mobile home of Edward Alger and Ann Peterson. When Alger failed to report for duty on Eglin Air Force Base, where he worked, his superior officer, Sergeant John Calloway, went to Alger's home. The body of a nude female was discovered in the front bedroom. Listener, I want you to remember when Renee Johnson was found discarded on that beach. All those years ago, when Frank was 14, what base was that nearby? That's right, Eglin Air Force Base. Calloway left immediately to telephone police. When investigators arrived, they identified the woman as Peterson. She was lying face down on the floor of the front bedroom, shot twice in the head, once through the neck. Alger's nude body was found on the floor of the second bedroom. His feet were tied with a curtain cord, and a piece of the same cord was tied to his left wrist. Alger had been shot 3 times, and his throat cut. A warrant was obtained to search the mobile home where Walls lived with his roommate. The warrant was issued based primarily on information given to the investigator by Frank Walls' former roommate, who lived in the mobile home adjacent to that of the victims. A number of items were seized during the search that were linked to the crime scene. Walls was charged with 10 offenses. Some of these charges were dismissed or reduced to lesser offenses, following Walls' motion for judgment of acquittal at the conclusion of the trial. Following his arrest, Walls gave a statement to the investigators, detailing his involvement in the murders. In this confession, Walls indicated that he deliberately woke up the 2 victims by knocking over a fan after entering the house to commit a burglary. Then he forced Alger to lie on the floor and made Peterson tie him up so that his hands were behind the back, ankles shackled. He next forced Peterson to lie on the floor so he could tie her up in the same manner. Walls stated that Alger later got loose from his bindings and attacked Walls. During the fight, Walls tackled Alger, forced him to the floor, and caught Alger across the throat with the knife. Alger continued struggling with Walls and succeeded in biting him on the leg. At this point, Walls apparently dropped his knife. It wasn't working. Walls then pulled out his gun, and he shot Alger several times in the head. Walls returned to Peterson. He found her, quote, laying in there, crying and everything. Asked me some questions. Walls said he could not understand what she was saying, so he removed her gag. She asked if Alger was all right. Walls told her no. He told her what was going on, and he said, I came in here, and I didn't want to hurt none of y'all. I didn't want to hurt you, but he attacked my ass. And things just happened. Walls then untied Peterson and, quote, started wrestling around with her. During this second struggle, he ripped off Peterson's clothing for reasons he's never confessed to. Walls' confession stated, she was like curled up crying, like, I don't know. I guess I was paranoid and everything. I didn't want no witnesses. All I know is I just went out. I just pulled the trigger a few times right there behind her head. I mean, close range. I mean, shit, her skin's got powder burns and everything. Walls stated that after the first shot, Peterson was doing all kinds of screaming. It didn't kill her. The bullet didn't fully penetrate the back of her skull, so Frank Walls shot again. But this time, in the struggle, he missed the back of her head. The bullet went through the back of her neck and out of her throat, now gurgling mixed with her screaming. The situation was getting worse. Finally, Frank forced her face into a pillow. He pressed the gun to the back of Peterson's head and then shot her a final time. Peterson fell silent. Walls pled not guilty and filed several pretrial motions, including a motion to determine his competency to stand trial. 5 experts testified, 3 stating Walls was incompetent and 2 finding he was competent. The trial judge agreed with the latter 2 experts and held that Walls was competent to stand trial. The jury found Walls guilty of all charges and later recommended life imprisonment for the murder of Alger and death for the murder of Peterson. And so Frank Walls was sentenced to death. But here's where things get complicated. The conviction later was reversed and a new trial was ordered. At the retrial, the venue was moved from Okaloosa to Jackson County. Because of pretrial publicity, the state's guilt phase case consisted primarily of the physical evidence, testimony by investigating officers, testimony by a pathologist, and Walls' taped confession, which was played for the jury. Walls chose to present no case in the guilt phase. The jury later found Walls guilty as charged. Along with Alger and Peterson, Walls took a plea in the murder of Audrey Gigi and confessed that he had also killed Tommy Lou Whitten in 1985 and Cynthia Sue Condra in 1986. Frank was guarded with information on those murders. He admitted to killing them, but not much else. During the penalty phase, the defense presented a case that detailed Walls' considerable history of violence or threatening behavior, various emotional problems, and extensive treatment for the latter, including a stay at an Eckerd residential youth camp. A psychiatrist who had treated Walls when he was 16 years old stated that he had placed Walls on the drug lithium carbonate to control his bipolar mood disorder. At some point, the psychiatrist said Walls ceased taking the drug. When asked if Walls had ever been under the influence of extreme or emotional disturbance, the psychiatrist stated, "He showed some severe difficulties with acting out behavior. When you get to the point of pushing teachers, getting to the point of being placed in an emotionally handicapped class, because you can't control your behavior, you have reached a point where you are having severe behavioral problems. I don't know that I would use the word extreme, but I would use the word severe." However, the psychiatrist did agree that, at age 16, Walls understood right from wrong, and legal from illegal behavior. An expert psychologist stated that Walls' IQ had declined substantially during the years prior to the trial. This psychologist answered yes when asked whether Walls' conduct was substantially impaired or impaired to any degree in July of 1987, when the murder was committed. After the penalty phase, the jury recommended the death penalty for the Peterson murder by unanimous vote. The judge sentenced Walls to 5 years for burglary of a structure, 20 years for the armed burglary of the dwelling, 20 years for 2 counts of kidnapping, and 2 months for petty theft. Walls again received a life sentence for the murder of Alger and death for the murder of Peterson. In 2018, Don Vinson, the lead investigator that brought Frank Walls down, was interviewed by Northwest Florida Daily News. In the interview, Vinson spoke more about Frank Walls than the investigation itself. I imagine he still had that homicide detective in him, reminding him that the specifics weren't the business of the media.
I was the chief investigator of the department. And when he was doing the killings, the ones that we know of, I was at the scene of each crime. And then after he was arrested, well, I got to know him real well. He told us about the crime. He told us about the two that he was charged with, the Ed Alger and Ann Peterson. He had killed them 3 days, 4 days before, maybe a week before. And he would tell you what he wanted you to know. He wouldn't volunteer information at first. Interviewed him again. And he told us basically the same thing he told them. That he did it, and he don't know why it happened, or he just, how'd he put it? I just went off. So basically that was it. You know, he I don't think he was honest. He told us stuff that we could prove. He didn't tell us anything that we couldn't prove. The people that he confessed to later on was the ones that he had sex with. So there was DNA, you know, involved. And he knew it, I think. And that's the reason he told us about the 5 people that he killed. I don't think that, for some reason, I don't think he'll ever be executed. At one time, I did. Frank Walls said back then he'd never be executed. And back then I thought he would be. But after, 30 years? I don't think he will be.
Frank Walls sits on death row today. Every so often he appeals, and it makes national headlines, with organizations like Amnesty USA asking the tough questions, is executing a man with a brain disorder timely justice? And will Frank Walls' youth at the time of the crimes, his mental illness, and his subsequent remorse be taken into consideration? On February 16, 2023, the Supreme Court again denied his intellectual disability claim, and upheld his death penalty sentence. Quote, Walls asserted that he should receive a new hearing on this issue because a new standard for intellectual disability was set forth after his conviction had become final in 1995. The Florida Supreme Court rejected his new claim and held the new standard cannot be retroactively applied to him. Therefore, his death sentence has been affirmed once again. Listener, one thing that concerns me, and I can't get over it when discussing this case, is that Frank Walls appears to be playing up his lack of intelligence. Experts have stated there isn't a scientific basis for a sudden and drastic dip in IQ, with one expert pointing out that when Frank was asked what his height and weight is, he took out his prisoner ID to check. This act was viewed as clearly performative. So for me, if he's intelligent enough to know right from wrong, what's illegal and legal, and intelligent enough for self-preservation, what does that say? Prison staff reported that Frank had given his height out frequently directly from his memory. It wasn't until Frank was being questioned about his intelligence that suddenly he didn't know the answer. That is to say that Mr. Walls conveniently forgot his height and his weight when his life is at stake. Listener, when you read the reports at that time, people in that small community were terrified. It is a trailer home community filled with people that some in society would consider and label as lesser victims. And this hulking beast, a killer of at least five, he would break into their homes. In the late hours of the night, these victims, mostly women, would have their throats slashed. They'd die choking on their own blood, or they would be executed slowly with a small caliber gun. It is believed, of course, that there were more victims, because at least one of Frank Wells' victims was a crime of opportunity, carried out on a nearby beach in broad daylight, right in the open. Chief Investigator Don Vinson is the hero of this story. Don and his team worked these murders hard. There were no lesser victims in this case. Despite several of the victims falling under the category of sex worker or drug addict, no. Bodies were piling up, and Chief Investigator Vinson worked this case like he would any other. If anyone is worth saving, then everyone is worth saving. Right, listener? And they got their man. Vinson was able to secure a confession as Frank Wall's lawyer was on the way to the jail. Don Vinson's daughter would later recall to the Northwest Florida Daily News, My dad was not a big guy, but he could get into your head. His style was to be friends with the criminals, and it was effective. His was all, hey buddy, we've all done that. We've all been there. Why don't you tell me about it? Dad showed me the confession before anyone else saw it. Frank's attorneys were very upset. He got it without them being there. Don liked to joke with his colleagues that Frank Walls would outlive him. To quote the Daily News, although the Walls case played a significant role in the life of Don Vinson, his daughter continues to keep tabs on the fate of the convicted serial killer. It did not consume him. He was a 42-year member of the Fort Walton Elks and worked for the local lodge following his retirement. He was born on May 14, 1937, at Lake Okeechobee. His father worked on the Flagler Railroad, and Vinson spent many of his formative years in work camps. He graduated from Bunnell High School, and there is a page dedicated to him in his yearbook for his sports prowess. He joined the FHP following a 4-year stint in the Air Force, and he never forgot his time with his father working amongst the blue collar. Vinson joined the sheriff's office to work as then Sheriff Mills' chief of administration. He was made an investigator 4 years later when Gilbert took office. He retired in 1996. Then his wife, Melinda, died 2 years later. Don's daughter was worried that her dad would fall ill from a broken heart. Then the lucky man met another soulmate, Janine. She was his angel whenever Don did get sick. Don's daughter believes he lived longer because of her. Don R. Vinson Sr. passed away January 10, 2022, at the age of 84. He is survived by longtime companion, Janine Dinwiddie, a daughter, Leah Osterman, two granddaughters, Dawn Ray and Ashley Bailey Osterman, and a son, Don Jr. Obscura does not often give out the hero roll call. A murder investigation is a multi-pronged affair that relies on the expertise of many. But it became clear to me while writing this episode that Don Vinson was vital in taking this monster down. And personally, this host wishes him well and a safe journey wherever death takes him. Thank you, Don. You saved a lot of people.